Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today, let's start out talking about the job numbers that just came out. Of course, they're getting a big spin, big hype from the Trump administration. Instead of 14.7 million, or 14.7%, excuse me, unemployment last numbers previous month, we've got a 13.3% unemployment rate. Well, it's going down. And of course, Trump administration's really spinning that one. You know, most economists, virtually all, were forecasting 20% up from 14.7. 20%. Well, instead it goes down to 13.3%. How can that be? Well, there's some traditional problems with that number, which I'll repeat, I've talked about before. But there's some new additional problems with that number that even the Labor Department admits that we should note. First of all, consider the fact that since February, we've had 43 million people applying for unemployment benefits. 43 million. And in fact, in the last 2 weeks, nearly 5 million. 5 million more, rather. Well, with 5 million more people unemployed on top of, what, 38 million before that, how the hell do we get a reduction in the unemployment rate to 13.3? Well, as I pointed out before talking about these statistics, it doesn't count the last 2 weeks of the previous month. So that 5 million more filing for unemployment benefits is not included. It only covers up to the midpoint of the previous month. You know, what comes out as May unemployment is really just the first 2 weeks of May and the last 2 weeks, of course, of April. But the big problem, or one of the big problems, is that this is only full-time employees, full-time workers included in this 13.3%. This is the what's called the U-3 unemployment rate. And we've got 50, 60 million people who are not full-time workers. They're part-time, they're temp, they're contract, they're gig, or what we call sometimes contingent. In other words, they don't have a permanent full-time relationship to their employer. They're contingent workers. And that's not in this U-3 13.3% statistic. You know, the total labor force right before this crisis was under 64 million people, either working or looking for work. You see, that's the definition of the labor force, looking for work, actively looking for work in the past 4 weeks, or working. That's the way we calculate unemployment in the United States. Okay, so if you're part-time, temp, contract, gig, you're not included in that full-time unemployment rate, 13.3%. And if you add those, you're adding, you know, another 5, 6, 7%, maybe more, to that total of 13.3. Well, that's one of the problems. You know, one of the problems, again, to recap up to now, doesn't count the last 2 weeks and the 5 million who filed. Secondly, it doesn't include part-time, temp, gig, whatever. Thirdly, that number by the Labor Department does not include the new category of what's called the PUA. In other words, for the first time, they're counting gig workers and independent contractors who previously were considered not workers, but business people. So now they're calculating those numbers But that's not included in this Labor Department number here, 13.3. That's a separate unemployment group. And, you know, they're having a hell of a time getting benefits. Last I heard, about a week ago, there were like 3.3 million of those who were trying to get benefits, still hadn't gotten the benefits, maybe 4 million. Now, you got to understand, unemployed is not simply people getting benefits. You can not be getting benefits for various reasons, unemployment benefits, and still be jobless, unemployed. So there's people in the pipeline still trying to get benefits, whether they're contractors, gigging, whatever, and others. And there's the last 2 weeks of 5 million. That's, none of that is in, and there's no part-time temp in that U3 number, 13.3%. Now, I've said all that before, but there's another problem with these numbers. And the Labor Department admits it. Since the coronavirus, they've added categories to their interviews. You see, they get the unemployment numbers by interviewing people. 50, 60,000 people every month are interviewed, mostly by phone. Now, that's a problem, interviewing people by phone, because it's mostly people who have a established address. And it used to be, until recent years, only people with established address and a landline. Now, they've been trying to pick up more people because, you know, millennials and Gen Zers and so forth, they don't have landlines. They have cell phones. Well, they've been adding cell phones to it, mobile phones. But that's not really representational yet. You know, they're still trying to fix that. So it's representational. But the problem is, you know, 50, 60,000 phone interviews, you know, of people, individuals, call their homes, ask them, it's a sample survey, ask them, you know, are you out of work? First question. Second question, are you looking for work? Third question, when's the latest time you looked for work? So you got to be out of work, looking for work. Has nothing to do with whether you got benefits, you see. Out of work, looking for work, and did you look within the last 4 weeks? Look meaning try to find a job the last 4 weeks. Well, a lot of people aren't even trying to find jobs because they know they're not out there the last 3 months, right? Well, that's how they define the U3, 13.3%. But there's a problem there. Labor Department admits, just in the last 3 months, when it does the survey, Labor Department does the survey, it's asked a couple of other questions. You know, one is, are you employed on temporary layoff? And it asks, or unemployed on temporary layoff? Now, think about that. If I've been furloughed here, you know, by my employer, what do I consider my condition? Am I still employed and on temporary layoff, or am I unemployed on temporary layoff? Well, a lot of the respondents on the phone interviews have confused this. To a lot of them, they think they're employed, but on temporary layoff. They don't think they're unemployed on temporary layoff. You see, it's a bad question. Now, if I'm unemployed, if I've been furloughed, right, and I consider myself still employed with this company, they're going to call me back. Huh? I'm going to get counted as employed. I'm jobless. I'm not working. I'm not looking for work because I'm employed. You see, it biases the numbers in two directions, right? Those who are unemployed are being counted as employed, raising the number of employed, and same time, reducing the number of unemployed. In other words, I'm affecting the numerator and the denominator of the calculation of the unemployment rate. So it's like a double underestimation effect. How many of these people, you know, fall into that category of confusion? Employed on temporarily. They don't know. They just ask that dumb question in that dumb way and get a distorted answer. Because most people, you know, they like to think I'm not jobless. You know, it's the same thing phenomenon when people get laid off from their employer. I mean, permanent layoff, right? What do? If they're, you know, middle management or professionals or even marketing people and so forth, they say, oh, I'm a consultant now. I'm employed. You're not making any money. You know, you have no job, but you hung out your shingle and you say, oh, I'm employed. I'm a consultant now, an independent contractor. I'm employed. Maybe you got no contracts, no work, but you're employed. That's why we have so many people now rising in the category of independent contractor, both corporated and unincorporated. But it's similar, you know, the situation of poor questions needs to be corrected. Well, you know, it biases to the low side here on the unemployment rate. Biases it. And there's another problem that needs to be continually emphasized, and that is the way the U.S. calculates the unemployment rate, right? As I said, you got to be out of work and looking for work within 4 weeks. Now, what happens if you just drop out of the labor force? You give up. Dropped out meaning, hey, there's no jobs out there. Everybody is laid off. I'm not going to waste my time trying to find a job. Besides, my company may call me back. So I'm out of the labor force. And those folks may get a call, a sample of them at least, and they say, are you looking for work? No, I'm not looking. It's a waste of time. There's nothing out there. Well, then they put him in this category. The government puts him in a category called not in the labor force. The labor force participation rate then drops precipitously. You know, labor force participation rate is how many people of a certain age, working age, 16 to whatever, are actually working or looking actively for work in 4 weeks. You know, that's the labor force participation. You know, we had a labor force of 164.5 million people in January. But what is the size of that labor force now? How many people simply dropped out of the labor force and therefore aren't considered in the calculations for the labor force participation rate? Well, if you look at the government statistics, 61.1%, that was employment population ratio. We'll talk about that shortly, too. If you look at February, we had 95 million people, seasonally adjusted, not in the labor force. Well, what's the latest figure? Just shy of 102 million not in the labor force. So in other words, 7 million people dropped out of the labor force since February. Well, actually, we should go back to January, right? We have 94,896 people not in the labor force. Let's say 95 million. And, 102 million now not in the labor force. It's the same for January, February, because this thing doesn't really hit till March. So we got 7 million more people dropped out. 7 million people dropped out of the labor force. And remember, they are not calculated in the statistic that gives you U-3. They're not included. 7 million. Well, add 7 million to the numbers, and what do you think happens to the unemployment rate? It goes way up. You know, when you when you calculate in, not in the labor force, 7 million people dropped out of the labor force, labor force participation rate drops precipitously like that, right? What do you get? Well, you got 25% plus unemployment. 25% plus. Maybe closer to 30% when you figure the last 2 weeks, those filing, when you figure in the PUA special category here for gig and so forth, independent contractors. When you look at all the numbers and all the statistics, you get a more accurate picture. You don't get this 13.3. Well, why do we keep getting 13.3? Well, because it's the most conservative, underrepresented partial number, and they like to push that number, you see. And the media goes along with it. I mean, read your newspapers, listen to the shows, news shows. What do you get? 13.3. This was the last time we got 14.7. That's all you get. No one explains that that's just a subset and distorted figure for the total unemployment levels and unemployment rate. No one bothers to explain that. It's not that they're lying. It's not that the Labor Department is lying. It's that they're cherry-picking, you see, cherry-picking the most conservative number. And the media goes along with it. And, of course, the politicians like that. I mean, even the government itself has what's called the U-6 unemployment rate, which adds part-time and temp. It underestimates those numbers, I believe. But at least they report some of the part-time temp and dropouts, some. I'm not going to go into what's wrong with the U-4, U-5, U-6. That's a technical question here. But they pick up some of that, you know. And when they pick up that, you get a higher unemployment rate than 13.3. You get a higher rate than that. You know, we lost 15 million full-time workers, but we lost 7 million more part-time workers, even according to the official numbers. You know, just go to the unemployment situation report today. And the part-time workers are underestimated, I believe. And they don't account for those not in the labor force, that's 7 million more. Well, you know, 15 million here full-time, 7 million part-time, that's 22. Another 7 million dropped out of the labor force, that's 29 million, right? You got the 3 million people who haven't filed on the independent contractors, the PUA. Okay, that's 32 million. You got people the last 2 weeks who filed for unemployment. That's 5 million. That's 38 million. Okay, you know, we're up around 40, 43 million again. My estimate is that we had about 50 million people unemployed. Now, some of them are going back to work, no doubt about it, as it opens up, as the economy opens up. So, you know, whatever your number is, 43 million on benefits, as of mid-May, well, some of that's coming down because people are coming back into work. But, you know, more people are fined for unemployment at the same time. What's the net? You know, I don't know. The government doesn't say how many have come in week by week and how many have found jobs week by week. It doesn't say that. So it's hard to tell what the net difference is between 5 million filing for unemployment in the last 2 weeks, and more dropping out of the labor force in the last 2 weeks of May. We don't know that. We'll see that next month, because it goes mid-month to mid-month, you see. There's another statistic besides the labor force participation, the 7 million dropped out, that gives us an indication of the labor force situation, and that's called the employment to population ratio. How many people in the country are employed as a ratio of the total. Okay. And that number has dropped from 61.1 to 52.8. I mean, the population hasn't changed that much month to month, but the ratio has dropped from 61 to 52, meaning a whole bunch of people left the labor force. You know, that sort of is the flip side of the coin indicator of the labor force participation dropout. But you don't hear about all of this additional calculation to clarify the true number of unemployed. If you listen to the media, and even less so if you listen to the Trump administration, right? Now, some will be coming back to work as it opens up, but a lot of people won't be coming back to the jobs they had because the jobs won't be there. You know, a lot of these jobs that have disappeared in recent months are in the service sector. You know, there's small service companies, small retail companies, restaurants, right? Local movie theaters and so forth. They're not coming back. In fact, I think the biggest movie chain, AMC, just declared bankruptcy. No one's going to go to movie theaters, and they're still not going to go to movie theaters, and they're still not going to go back to eating out the way they were, and they're still not going to go to malls. By the way, the malls are in big trouble. They're defaulting, i.e. going bankrupt, all over. Biggest malls in the country, you know, in New Jersey and in Minnesota, Mall of America, and so forth. Why? Because your big box retail stores that hold down those malls, you know, the Penny's, the Macy's, the Neiman Marcus's, and all the others, Lord Taylor, something like that, I forget the name of it, you know, they're all going bankrupt. They were in trouble before this. You know, borrowing high interest rate loans just to keep going. But I've been predicting for some years here now, last couple of years, that they're going to succumb when the next recession hits. And of course, now it's hit and they're succumbing. They're not going to open up. They're not going to rehire those folks. You know, what about hotels? Think people are going to start staying in hotels? No. Resorts, you know, Disneyland and places like that, are, you know, Six Flags, whatever, they're going to open up on skeleton crews just to see how many people are going to come back. Restaurants are going to do the same, just to see how many people do come back. They're not going to jump out there. And a lot of people aren't going to jump out and start spending too. Why? Because they're not sure what's going to happen in the future. They're not sure if there's going to be another relapse here. They're not sure if there's going to be another wave of the virus, which, of course, there will be. But I predict no matter how bad the second wave is, the economy will not shut down again. No way. Neither the politicians or businesses will want to do that, and they'll just say, well, we got to tough it out. Whoever dies, dies. Because they've already wounded their capitalist economy, you know, significantly here. Like I said, a lot of defaults, a lot of bankruptcies coming. A lot of companies won't open up at all, particularly small service companies. Some of them will open up only partially. And, you know, the service companies, particularly restaurants, work on a very tight margin. In other words, you know, they don't make that much profit per meal. And if you have the number of meals cut dramatically because not everyone's coming back, well, then they're not going to make their numbers, as they say, and they're not going to survive more than 3, 6, 9 months more, and they're going to start going under. So a lot of these companies that are starting to hire back, particularly in the service sector, aren't coming back. Or if they're coming back, they'll come back temporarily and won't survive down the road. What about education? Education services. Well, you know, in a lot of places in the fall, colleges and K through 12, it's going to be work from home. I mean, schooling from home totally, or it's going to be some hybrid mix. of remote education and in-class education. Now, if you're going to do most of it from remotely, you're not going to need as many teachers, and you're not going to need as many facility people at the physical educational sites. So you're not going to see all those education jobs come back either. Or if they come back, they're going to come back more on part-time temp basis, you see. Education is going to be totally changed in this country. And job security, if you're in education, is even going to get worse. Well, that's just education. What about state and local government, you know, hires 18, 20 million people in this country? It's not the federal government that hires so many people for federal programs. They're only a couple million people. It's the states and school districts that hire the vast majority of state and local employees. Most public employees are teachers. Vast majority are teachers. And the rest of them that work for states and cities and counties and so forth, right? We're going to see a lot of layoffs because they are in deep trouble. The state and local governments are in deep trouble. The total revenue collapse here almost for 3 months. McConnell and Trump don't want to bail out the cities and states. You know, in recessions in the past, whenever we had recessions, we had hiring more by state and local governments to absorb some of the unemployed. Well, the first time that did not happen was in 2008-09. Why? Because the states were in trouble in terms of financing. And the money that was given to them by the government, $300 billion in 2009, they sat on. They didn't hire in significant numbers, as they always had in the previous 10 recessions in the U.S. since World War II. So that was a change. Well, that's happening again. State and local governments are not only not going to hire, they're going to lay off too in the coming months. Offices, malls, hotels, all those industries hard hit by the travel collapse because of the virus, which is going to continue fear to some extent, going to be depressed. They're not going to hire people back in large numbers. So what we're going to get here is a floor under the collapse that occurred the first 3 months here. It's going to level out. Of course, Trump and the media are going to say, oh, see, we're recovering. It's going to be V-shaped. We're going to snap back next 3 months. Nonsense. So it's going to bounce along the bottom. And there will be a little bit of a recovery here. You just can't keep dropping through the floor as we have forever until the entire economy shuts down. The entire economy won't shut down. I mean, the Great Depression of the 30s, it did all shut down, you know, just a third of it maybe, in a worse time. And, you know, we've dropped, 33% in joblessness, true joblessness, if you calculate all the ways I've talked about. Okay, some of that will come back here over the summer. We'll get some of that back, but not very much of it, not even half of it, not even half. And then we run the risk when companies start defaulting and government starts cutting spending and the global economy does not recover, so export production and sales do not recover. And businesses don't invest in that kind of uncertain environment to expand, and especially since consumers won't be returning to their level of spending as before. Businesses are going to sit on their cash, and they already are. We'll talk about that shortly. And consumers are going to buy necessities, but we're going to be very careful about spending beyond that. They're going to try to hoard what cash they've got too. And then, of course, we may have another big hole in consumption because McConnell and Trump want to stop the extended unemployment benefits after July 21st. The extra $600 and the expansion, they want to stop it. Cut it. You know what they want to do? Instead of extending people's unemployment benefits, they want to give those benefits to businesses to help pay for the wages of businesses. In other words, instead of subsidizing the unemployment, they want to subsidize the businesses. Yeah, they're proposing. There's proposals now in Congress in debates going on over the HEROES Act, the next stimulus, right? The Republicans and Trump and McConnell don't want to extend the unemployment benefits. They want to force people to go back to work. And when they go back to work, they want to pay their wages at work. They figure, well, you know, instead of giving people money and unemployment benefits to spend, let's give the money to businesses and make the unemployed go back to work. So guess what? Who gets the big, big benefit? The businesses do. Is this the beginning of the end of unemployment insurance? I don't know. But this is an interesting trend where subsidies, wage subsidies to businesses instead of unemployment benefits to people. This could catch on, you know, and this could be the way of unemployment benefits in the future. And of course, when they give subsidies to businesses, not just to cover their wages of their employees, I think it's 80% they wanted to cover, it's not to cover the wages of their employees. Businesses will use it for other business expenditure reasons as well. So it's just another way to subsidize business. And by the way, you know, just think about it. We've just given small business $660 billion in grants, because the loans are going to be grants. No, it's free money. We've given them $660 billion with the understanding that they pay 75% of that to their workers' wages. In other words, the loans, the grants from the government have to be spent, three-fourths of which have to be spent for wages, keeping people on the job. Well, they're getting the loans, but they're not keeping people on the job. They're laying them off anyway and keeping the loans because no one's checking on it, you know? There's no investigation of that abuse. It'll come out later. But they're keeping the money. In some case, you know, they're bringing a few people back. But most of it is not 75% for wages, $660 billion. By the way, I think last figure I saw, only $511 billion of that $660 was actually distributed to small businesses, businesses with less than 500 employees. This is called the PPP program. Of the loans in the CARES Act passed in March, you know, $350 billion was passed first, and then bigger corporations stole most of that with the help of the banks, so they had to put another $320 million in. A billion, so it became to, you know, $670 billion for small business loans, which are grants, if you keep everybody on 75% on the job, which no one's checking, so they're getting the money for free. Yeah, $660 billion for free. Now, consider this. They're getting that money, a subsidy, a grant. And now the Republicans, McConnell and Trump and Congress, want to give them a wage subsidy payment. In other words, more money to, once again, to hire back their workers. Well, we gave them $660 billion not to lay the workers off. Now the ones they've laid off anyway, we're going to pay 80% of their wages, and we're going to take it out of the unemployment benefits. That's what's being proposed. I mean, it's never ending. throwing money at businesses and capitalists and corporations. It's never ending. They're just writing checks and slushing that money out of the workforce. And that's been going on since Reagan, but it's really accelerated under Obama. And it's really accelerating now even further under Trump. Massive income redistribution going on in this country. It boggles the mind. The trillions. And now it's accelerating, you see. And now they're going to destroy unemployment benefits by turning them into wage subsidies for business. And, of course, no one will really police that either, and we'll find out that, this 80% wage subsidies, maybe half of that was spent on wages and the rest was kept by businesses, you see. And what about medium-sized and large businesses? You know, with the CARES Act, there were three programs here. One was small businesses, less than 500 workers, and $660 billion. But then there was a medium-sized businesses with more than 500, which another $600 billion was allocated in loans. Another $600 billion. And then there was $500 billion more on top of that for big corporations, you know, like Boeing and so forth, right? $500 billion, $600 billion. You want to know how much of that $600 billion for medium-sized corporations has been spent so far by the government? Zero. Zero. Which says to me that those companies didn't need very much in terms of loans. And I'll explain why. And the big businesses, $500 billion, I think $50 billion was used mostly by small airlines, I think. Yeah. A good example is Boeing. You know, Boeing was supposed to get $61 billion out of that big business pot of $500 billion. $61 billion. And, of course, it had to keep people on the payroll. Boeing, which is essentially broke, at least on the commercial aircraft side, you know, they're big war aircraft contractors, so they're doing great on that side of the business. But the commercial airlines production is in problems. You know, it was in problems well over a year ago because their plane wouldn't fly. That new plane kept crashing, right? So they lost a lot of money. And the $61 billion was going to be given to them. They decided not to take it. Why? Because they didn't want to keep workers on their payroll. That's why. So instead now, what has Boeing done? It's gone out into the corporate bond market and borrowed $25 billion and laid off 16,000 workers. Instead of taking the loan from the government, in which it would kept workers on the payroll and wouldn't have to go borrow and add more to its debt in the public bond markets, corporate bond markets. And corporations all over are doing this, the big ones. They're not taking the loans from the government. Why? Because they're flush with cash and have been for months. Why were they flush for cash? Well, you got to remember the Trump tax cuts of 2018 and 19 gave them hundreds of billions of dollars they got to keep. You know, 2018, Trump's windfall tax cut for big corporations for the Fortune 500, 27% increase in profits. 22% of that 27% was due to the tax cut windfall. So they're flush with cash because of the Trump tax cuts, first of all. Second, they're flush with cash because they drew down their lines of credit with the banks in January, February. They knew this was coming. And how could corporations know this is coming and the government couldn't? Well, because the government's full of stupid people. And at the top of that stupid mountain is Donald Trump, the ignoramus when it comes to economics. All he thinks is the stock market. That's all that matters. Okay, so they drew down hundreds of billions of dollars, big corps did, in their credit lines with the banks. They stopped giving dividends and stock buybacks. They hoarded that cash. And how much is that? Well, in 2019, the Fortune 500 companies gave $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts to their shareholders. $1.3 trillion in 1 year. $3.4 trillion in 3 years under Trump. Corporations are the conduit for income redistribution in this country to the shareholders. The rest of us are struggling with no wage increases and filling up our credit cards, working 2-3 part-time jobs, and the corporations are raking it in hand over fist because of government policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy. It's a big redistribution machine going on. And has been. And it's just accelerating now under Trump. You know, stock buybacks, dividend payouts under Obama, you know, $700-900 billion a year. $1 trillion at the end there. And now $3.4 trillion under Trump. On top of it. In 10 years. In 10 years, you know, they've given back almost $10 trillion in buybacks and dividend payouts. And you know where most of that went? Where shareholders, investors put most of that? Right back into the stock market, or into bond markets, or into derivatives, or into foreign exchange, or into property, wherever. Offshore and onshore. That's where most of it's gone. Totally financialized capitalist economy now. And they're raking in the dough. And that government is enabling it all. Playing the role. Why? Because they've captured the government, you see. Citizens United and all the rest, they've captured it. Look who's making economic policy under Trump. Goldman Sachs. All those guys are from Goldman Sachs. Who wrote the $4.5 trillion 2018 tax cut for corporations and investors? Goldman Sachs. Two guys. Steve Mnuchin, former Goldman Sachs. And Gary Cohn, former Goldman Sachs. Behind closed doors. And they throw it out there right before Christmas. And Republicans then had both houses of Congress and they just pushed it through. As quick as they could. You know why they can't get rid of Trump? Because he is, he's rewarded them nicely, you see. Okay. So, hoarding cash, big profits, distributions, drawing down your credit lines, right? And thirdly, raising corporate bonds, issuing corporate bonds in January and February in record levels. Well, when you issue a bond, you sell the bond, you get cash from the buyers of the bond, right? And you give them a piece of paper. Record corporate bond balloon went on January, February. And that bond boom was accelerated by the Federal Reserve in March. How did that happen? Well, here's another boondoggle. How did that happen? The Federal Reserve said it was going to start buying corporate bonds. Yeah, it was going to buy the bonds. So issue them. Corporations issued mostly to private investors, but then the government would buy the corporate bonds from the private investors. The Fed in March indicated it would buy $750 billion in corporate bonds from investors. So a bunch of investors bought a lot of corporate bonds. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why corporations have not taken up the loans from the government. Why take up a loan you got to pay back, you know, with all the conditions, and I got to use part of it to hire people and keep them on a job when I can just issue corporate bonds and I don't have to do that. I can lay people off, i.e. Boeing, right? Why do that? So the Fed signaled to the corporate world that, oh, we'll buy the bonds, $750 billion. So corporations rushed and sold even more bonds in March and April to investors. And you know how much of that $750 billion the Fed has bought of corporate bonds that it announced in March? Nada. Nada. It hasn't bought any yet. Well, why? Well, because the price of bonds went way up, you see? All the demand for bonds and the sales of bonds, the prices went way up. The investors bought the bonds from the corporations at a low price. And now, when the Fed starts buying the bonds in July instead of in March, it's going to pay a higher price for them. That means the speculators in corporate bonds are going to make a capital gains killing. They bought the bonds at a certain rate in March, February, March, April, low during the crisis, right? And now they'll be able to sell them back to the Fed at a huge profit, short-term profit. Yeah. Is that a subsidy? You betcha. That's a subsidy for financial speculators that's going on right now. And that's what the Fed does. The Fed subsidizes the corporate sector, not just the banks, which it used to, just the banks subsidize, bail out the banks. No, now it said we're gonna do this for all the corporations, virtually non-financial as well as financial. We're going to do that for those guys too. We're even going to buy corporate exchange-traded funds, ETFs, very speculative, derivative. Yeah, we're going to buy that too. In other words, they're buying up all the debt from the corporate side, which accelerates the debt because everybody knows that the government, the Fed's going to buy it, so let's issue more of it, right? And then sell it to the Fed at higher prices. What a scam. Federal Reserve is a scam. The same thing's been happening with this bailout. It's a scam for corporations. It's a scam. Okay, so they've managed $500 billion out of the CARES Act for you and me. Extended unemployment benefits, right? The checks, the supplemental checks. But that was only supposed to last for 8 weeks. And, of course, all that is been used up. So now they're debating in Congress, in the HEROES Act, how can we extend it, the bailout of the middle class, the working class in this country? How can we extend it? Oh, that's where McConnell and Trump and so forth come in. No. No more extension for working folks. You know, we need to convert the unemployment benefits to wage subsidies for businesses. Ah, another bailout for business. Yeah, we got to do that. And no more supplemental unemployment checks. No. We force people back to work. You know, we got a war president. Donald Trump says he's war president, invoked the War Production Act. You know, the only thing he actually did with that was to force meatpacking workers back to work. That's the only thing he did. Yeah, what a war president, right? That's like a commander-in-chief saying, okay, all you guys, charge the machine guns. And that's the order of the general, right? His one order as he goes into battle. We're going to fight this. Chase the machine guns. Okay. Get mowed down. All right, so that's the problem we've got here with the unemployment statistics and so forth. I want to close with saying something about the demonstrations here. I've written a piece on my blog, Confronting Institutional Racism. Check it out, jackrasmus.com. Right. It's appeared Counterpunch, ZNet, Global Research, other places if you're interested. But in it, I commented, you know, on the main event of the week here going on. But two points I want to make about summarize, you know, what I had to say. One is this is not just a police brutality, a black protest going on. This is much deeper, much deeper. I mean, look at the people out there, mostly young, right? Most of the young folks, and across all racial lines, a lot of white folks out there, right? And they're millennials and Gen Zers. Why? Because that's the generation group that's really taken it in the ear for the last 10 years, at least. They're desperate. Desperate lives, you know? What have they got? They got part-time temp jobs, often two or three of them cobbled together, no insurance, right? Some of them, you know, burdened, indentured with student loans they'll never be able to pay back because of the interest rates. You know, going from apartment to apartment as the rents are raised. It can't afford to have a family normally, right? I mean, they're very frustrated, and rightly so. And they're all working class, you know. There's some middle class and professional people there and so forth. But this is where race and class have come together in a generation, you see, these protests. And they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop. They're going to continue. And they probably will reach another crescendo once the decision comes down about these cops and the brutality, you know, in Minnesota. And, you know, it's appearing elsewhere, you know, in Florida, in New York, and so forth. It's becoming aware now what's going on in terms of police brutality. You know, we got the militarization of the police force. Militarization going on. And, you know, in my article, I talk about how they've got to take this to the next level. You know, if it's just a protest about police brutality, as important as that is, and at the center of everything as that is, it's not enough. You know, recall what happened to Occupy. These spontaneous protests and movements without organization dissipated. And the government just waited it out and waited till it started fading. Then it cracked down on them, you see. The same thing in France, the Yellow Vests. If you don't have organization to take it to the next level and to appeal to new allies and to have a set of demands, universal demands, that are broad enough to bring in allies and have some sort of organizational structure to build, you know, build the movement, then it's going to dissipate, or it's going to be attacked by reaction and forces of the right with the help of the government and broken up and defeated temporarily, but defeated. It's got to come to the next level. They got to broaden it out. And they got to be the champions of law and order, not the police, not the right. You know, they got to do something about the looters. You can't let them loot. I proposed forming local community committees of safety to do that policing of the police on an ongoing, structured, organized basis to confront the provocateurs, which are rabid throughout these organizations, you know, the white supremacists coming in, the looters. You have to take a stand against the looters. You got the call for the restoration, not of just black business, but all the businesses that have been looted, or else the white businesses are going to fall into the lap of the radical right. You got to have a program, you see, and you got to have organization, and you got to build allies, and it's got to become more than that, because it already is more than that. It's a whole generation that's frustrated, angry, and expressing itself. Well, and you got to anticipate what the opposition is going to do. What are going to be their moves? Not just at the police level, tactically, you know, but strategically as well. How is Trump going to try to manipulate this? Well, you know, now they're calling for a national March on Washington in August, and that's good. The bigger the demonstrations and the protests, the better. The more difficult it is to oppress it. That's good. But, you know, watch for the right wing. They're going to call, I predict, another national protest demonstration in Washington of police forces and military forces and right-wing and supremacist forces. Trump's going to do that. And then what do we got? Well, we got two mass movements in the street. What does that look like? Well, that looks like 1930 Weimar Germany, doesn't it? That's where we're going. And you need to anticipate where all this is headed. In other words, think two or three steps down the road, whatever you do, what the likely response is going to be, what could you be your response to that response? I mean, it's like a union strike, you know. When I was in strikes and unions, you always had to anticipate what the next move of the employer is going to be and have a couple counter moves in your back pocket. What were you going to do when they do this? Or a union organizing drive, the same thing. What's the employer going to do? What's our response going to be, right? And you educate and tell people about what's going to happen before it happens, and that way, when it happens, they're not shocked. But all that takes organization, you see. And it takes a program that will bring in more people around the new organization. And the program and organization has to be not just police brutality, but more. Has to be more than that, because it's economic. You see, the brutality is rooted in the economics of the situation. You know, and remember what Dr. Martin Luther King was doing right before they assassinated him, right? He was beginning to take the civil rights movement into an economic rights movement. He was beginning to champion labor and workers and other minorities. Now, that was really dangerous. I think that's why they got him. He was going somewhere beyond just political equality or social equality. You can't have social equality without economic equality. I mean, you can get all kinds of black folks elected to Congress and so forth, you know, which is what happened since the 1960s and 70s. And what has it changed for them economically? Nothing. Okay, well, that's enough of my comment on that. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure, going forward. But we'll watch what's happening here with the HEROES Act next week.